Hey, folks, if you're looking for a podcast that feels like a conversation with your best friend, then we recommend checking out Text Me Back, a new show from our podcast friends at KUOW in Seattle. Text Me Back is hosted by best-selling author Lindy West and her real-life best friend, democracy and judiciary policy expert Megan Hatcher Mays. Listening in on these two smart, hilarious women's long-distance friendship is sure to make you laugh and smile, even on those bleak winter days. In each episode, Lindy and Megan dig into what's going on in their lives, the news, and their text chains, be it politics, strange headlines, and new pop culture obsessions. Text Me Back is about making your favorite people laugh, even when the world gets you down. Give them a follow wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and every Thursday, we release these special episodes where we look back at content from the earlier years of the podcast. This week, it's the best of true crime stories, number one. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Ed Gavigan. Before that, from the late Jim Paydar. And we're going to start things out with the one and only Marjorie Winther. Now, I'm sure you guessed from the title of the episode, from all these stories being about true crime, that all three of these stories have either physical violence or sexual violations involved. So, heads up about that. Let's start out with Marjorie Winther with a story we call My Own Life.
Is this working? Yes. Okay. So I was looking around my room this morning, and it was like filled with empty beer bottles and condom wrappers. And I thought, this is not how I expected to spend my 58th year. Because I used to be married. I was married for 30 years, and I was like a companionable marriage. Like my husband, Austin, he was one of those guys with a button-down shirt with a mechanical pencil, and he was a teacher, and he was actually a great teacher, and later a professor, and he thought very carefully about American education, and he was committed to learning, and I loved that about him. I loved that, and from the eyebrows up, we had a great marriage. But there was no passion, and there was no sex for years, and I called him out, like, we never have sex, and he said, very matter of fact, he said, you know, I'm not attracted to you. I love you, but you're fat, and I'm not attracted to you, and it hurt, but not as much as you might think, because I really wasn't that attracted to him because he's skinny. So I went along, you know, I was happy enough. You know, like we never fought. Like maybe we didn't like roll around like the Burt Lancaster in From Here to Eternity, but that's just the movies. You know, you don't always get everything. I made that trade-off that people make where you give up the idea of ever having fun again, and in return you get security and a Toyota Prius. And you don't have to walk through the world alone. And I would still be in that marriage, except one day, 2 years ago, I was at work and the phone rang, and it was my son. He said, Mom, Dad got arrested. I was like, what? He goes, yeah, like the FBI's here. Like they were like pounding on the door, woke me up. And I'm like, what? He goes, I guess like he was at the airport like trying to have sex with like some girl or something. I was like, oh my God, Daddy, what, Daddy? Daddy, what's that? I was like, oh my God, like I gotta go home, my kid is home, I gotta go home, like I panicked, I left work, I flew home, and there are these like 7 FBI agents in my house, like, and they're wearing like these khaki pants and bulletproof vests, and they locked my puppy, I had a puppy, they locked him in the yard. They're like, safety, I'm like, Like, you're the FBI. Like, you, like, chase down serial killers. Like, he's a... But they sat me down. I said, ma'am, did you know your husband was at the airport? No, I didn't. I didn't know. Did you know that, you know, we've been, you know, he's been corresponding with a woman and her 13-year-old daughter, and he sent them a plane ticket. He's been making arrangements for them to come to Philadelphia for sex. And did you know that? No, I didn't know that. I mean, I knew he was in his room all the time, like on the internet, but I thought like he was just looking at porn like a normal man. So I didn't know any of this. And I was just like, and then they said, tell me like all, you gotta call this person, do this and go down there. And you know, you gotta, there's all this like, you know, you gotta go to court, there's hearings, you gotta go to a lawyer. There's all this like whole like legal process, you know, that I had to learn about. You know, like if you've heard the expression, like, don't make a federal case of it. That's what I was. So they left. My son drove me to the airport to get the car. And I was actually, like, it's funny, the little things that piss you off. Like, you think it would be the big things, but it's like, I got to pay for the fucking car at the airport, like, short-term parking. Like, what was he thinking? Like, you know. It's the little things. It's just, I don't know. And I was so worried about my son. It's like, how are you, Paul, your dad, like, how are you? He goes, Mom, my son was very calm. Mom, I'm not going to form an opinion till I've talked to Dad. We just have one side of the story. And that sounded like a plan. Like, I should talk to him. Like, because this just didn't seem like the guy I knew. You know, this isn't something he would do. And so I was just like in this zombie state. Like, I wasn't crying or freaking out. And, you know, I was just like I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. Jody came over and tried to make me eat a sandwich. I couldn't. You know, it was just like I just couldn't function. But there was all this stuff you had to do. You know, you have to get a lawyer. You have to go down. You have to do all this stuff. And I said, I need to talk to him. I need to talk to him. You can't just like waltz into the prison. Like there's a process. There's like background checks. It took like, I don't know, weeks and weeks before I could go see him. And finally, like, I was cleared to go visit him. And I went down there. And that's a whole thing. Like, any of you guys ever gone to the prison? Like, you can't just like, hey, hi. You know, it's like, there's all these rules. And I was watching, like, you're in the waiting room. And they kept turning people away. Like, if their pants were too tight, you can't get in. Or, you know, this, no. This And, you know, little kids are getting turned away. I mean, it's like there's all these rules. And then you have to go through the metal detector. It's the most sensitive the people in the waiting room, they used to call it the stopper, you know, because you go, beep, and it's like, what? You know, like, I'm taking off my, you know, and it just kept beeping. And I'm like, why is this beeping? Why? And there were, like, fortunately, like, some mafia wives in the waiting room. They're like, honey, are you wearing an underwire? And I was like, yeah, take off your bra. I'm like, okay, you know, which is not a good look for me, but, you know, but I did. I got in to talk to Austin, and you're sitting, it's not like, it doesn't have the glass, it's like the, no, it's like it's rows of plastic chairs, and you sit on one side, and they said that there's low tables, because it has to be low, because they don't want people, like, diddling each other, I guess, under the table, which we weren't going to do, because why start now, you know? But he came out, and he said, I'm so happy to see you. I'm so happy. And he said, I want to make it up to you. I want to make amends. How are you gonna do that? Like how do you make amends to your wife that you were trying to have sex with a 13-year-old? Like, what are you gonna do, fuck an old lady and split the difference? And he's like, that wasn't his plan. He had a plan. He said, you know, from my cell, I can see these like double decker buses going by. I wanna take you on a double decker bus ride. And that will be even. You know, it's like, oh, you know, but I didn't hate him yet. It's just because I couldn't meld the, you know, this is this guy, this teacher, this brilliant scholar, and this is this, you know, like I couldn't get mad at him because it didn't work. It didn't it didn't fit. I was just like walking around in this kind of zombie state. And he told me, he said to me, Margie, I know you're not going to believe me, but I wasn't going to go through with it. It was just a fantasy. And it got, you know, out of control. I mean, I'm looking at a 10-year prison term for having a fantasy. Like, he's the victim, you know? And I believed him because I was used to believing him. I was just in the habit of believing him. But there were little details that were like, and I was like, wait a minute, the FBI, you have $400 in your pocket. And he goes, I was going to take them to lunch. And it's just a lot of things that didn't make sense. But it took me a while to kind of figure out that he was lying. You know, like I used to take the bus to work because I'm an asshole, I guess. I don't know, he was home, but I wanted him to have the car, so I would take the bus, and then he would pick me up at the train. Well, the day he got arrested, he had emailed me that morning and said, I'm not going to be able to pick you up at the train. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, yeah, you're having this illicit affair. You can't be done by 5:47, you know? And it just finally hit me that, like, he didn't care about me. He didn't have my back. And I still couldn't really fall apart. And I was just kind of, I wasn't eating, I wasn't sleeping, I was just worrying all the time. You know, I was just worrying what's going to happen. I was just worried. And one of my neighbors came over, and this like fits with your story, Brady, because one of my neighbors came over, and she was the wife of the pastor of the Baptist church around the corner from me, and she invited me to come to church with her. And I said, okay, I'll go. And I went to church. If you've ever been to a Baptist church, it's like a lot of rhythm, you know, and the sermon, and it got to the point, I hadn't even cried yet, but it got to the point in the sermon where the preacher said, lead us not into temptation. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And I finally cried. And I was immediately like embraced by women in fabulous hats. It felt so good to cry that I decided to go to a blues bar that night and just like purge my pain. But it didn't work out. The bar I went to was in Chestnut Hill. I didn't have to say anything else, y'all know. So like the musicians, like had never like really been through anything. So. So it was like, I'll just give a demo. It was like, you know, good, join me. I was mildly inconvenienced, you know. It was like. So I was like pretending I was Janis Joplin, and I was like shooting back like Southern Comfort, and like I started singing like louder than the band, like Joplin songs, like I was gonna lay my head on a lonely railroad line, and I was just like, and I was just singing, and the manager's like, miss, you know, you can't do that. And I was like, well then give me something I can wallow in. And he's like, you're gonna either have to shut up or you're gonna have to leave. So I left. And I was sitting on the curb outside the bar. And I thought, this is like my lowest point ever. I've been thrown out of a blues bar for being too sad. But I knew what I had to do. I had to put my life together. And I thought, I've been looking at this as the day my life fell apart. Well, now I was looking at it as my second chance. You know? And I was thinking, it's not enough to be happy enough. And I was putting that thought into the universe. And I know there are people who think if you put a vision into the universe will respond and give you a pony. But I don't really think that. Like, I'm like Jewish, so I think like if you put your vision into the universe, you are daring the universe to fuck with you. Oh, the Jews clap. Yeah. Kanahara, poo poo poo. That's Yiddish for like, go away, evil eye. We say it a lot. Kanahara. Yeah, you don't find Kanahara. Like, you know, you just can't take anything for granted. It's a dangerous cosmos. And I'm thinking, like, it's not enough to be happy enough. I want more. I want lots and lots and lots of life. And I was a little afraid, you know, that the universe would think I was being greedy. But then I remembered, like, my grandmother used to tell me, she was in charge of my religious education, and I mean, I found out later she was just making shit up. But what she told me when I was little, she was like, Mashallah, when you die, you will have to answer to God for every pleasure that you declined. Yeah. Like her vision of God, like God was like a hostess. It was like, I made it all for you. 7 days I worked, you know, try it. Try it. So I wasn't being greedy, I was being worshipful. And I thought, what I want, I know what I want. I want lots of stories, and I want lots of dancing, and I want lots of men. And it's not that I think the universe owes me these things, but I owe myself the guts to go after it. So, dancing, I joined a soul dancing class, which is like so great. Like I learned like the Freetown strut and the Cupid shuffle, but you know, I mean, I was the only white person in the class, so it was like a little weird, you know, I mean, everybody was nice, but it's like, it's, you know, it's like I can't, you know, like, you know, push it good, you know. I'm white, I push it well. And I had the guts to come to First Person Arts and tell a story, and the universe gave me Karina and Kevin and thank you, universe, like, please don't fuck with me. And then I thought, man, oh, that's gonna be hard, you know, because like, I know I'm not like all that. But apparently I am all this. And yeah, and like Kevin said, I mean, to quote Kevin Allison, there's men who like fat, hairy people. And I want to make out with all of them. So where I'm going. So I put it in the universe. I want some men in my life. And if you're going to fuck with me, do it the good way. And as you already know, my bedroom's filled with beer bottles and empty condom wrappers. I mean, I just put the thought out, universe, you know, if you can send me like a nice single Jewish lawyer, habeas corpus. And I come to understand that I used to look at that as the day that Austin was arrested. I used to look at that as the day my life fell apart, like the character in an Oprah book club selection. But I've come to look at it as the day my life became my own. Thank you.
We'll be right back. We're back.
It was summer of 1975. I was working homicide with my regular partner, Mike, out of the Maxwell Street station. The call was a man stabbed in the play lot at the Henry Horner Project on West Side of Chicago. We were literally right there. All we had to do was pull our squad to the curb and get out. Obviously, we were the first officers on the scene. We were dressed as what I call summer homicide. It's short sleeve, dress shirt with a tie, light trousers for the summertime. We trotted towards the play lot, and instinctively we slowed because there was a crowd there, like you would expect, but they were strangely quiet. One of those situations that makes a cop's hair stand up on the back of his neck. Something was going on here out of the ordinary. We unsnapped our holsters, put our hands on our snub-nosed revolvers, and slowed down. As we approached the crowd, they cleared a path for us, and we walked in. Now, this was not a nice place to be, because a couple months before, a Chicago police officer had been shot and killed by a sniper from these very buildings. But in the middle of this crowd lay a young, muscular black male on his back who had been stabbed in the right side of his neck, the carotid artery to be specific. Every time his heart beat, he would send a stream about 10 or 15 feet out. And that's what the crowd was watching. And every once in a while, he would writhe a little bit or move, and the stream would change a little bit direction, and the crowd would murmur and step back. My partner and I had the same instantaneous reaction. Oh, shit. Now, we had watched people bleed out in our homicide careers and our police careers from massive injuries, massive head injuries, and there was nothing you could do except pretty much watch them bleed out. But this was different because there was a point. There was a specific point of where the blood was coming from. And Mike and I recognized that. Mike said, I'll get a compress. In our squad, we carried a 4-inch compress. We had no radio because in those days, the radios were firmly affixed to the dashboard of the car. As he sped off, and I said, you know, and call an ambulance. I watched and I kind of moved back and forth, and I managed to get into this kid's neck and put my hand right on that spot. I didn't get any direct hit. I could feel his pulse, but the bleeding stopped. So I just held my fingers there. It was going to be one of the most bizarre experiences of my entire police career. As I knelt there alongside of him, he was wide-eyed, conscious, looking at me. The only way I could describe the expression on his face is what I would call primal fear. I could hear the sirens wailing in the background. I knew help was on the way. It seemed like an infinite amount of time. I know it was in reality probably only a minute and a half. Suddenly through the crowd came the uniform officers from the 12th District, my partner, and two paramedics. They stopped, and their reaction was similar. Oh, shit. They looked at the streams that had stained the concrete, and they said, is that where your fingers are now? I says, yeah. He says, don't move your fingers. Okay, I wasn't planning on it. So they start unpacking their bag of magic, I thought. I didn't know what they were going to do, but their magic turned out to be yards and yards of ace bandages wrapped around my hand and his neck. And they kept yelling at me, you know, flatten your hand out, keep your fingers, or pressure, pressure, maintain pressure. I'm thinking, that's what I'm doing, yeah. I says, and your plan is? And he says, you're going with us. Okay. So the other paramedic went back to the ambulance. He comes back with a stretcher. And in a few minutes, we were gliding back to the ambulance. We get to the ambulance. It's obvious that I am bandaged into him in the wrong direction for conventional transport in this ambulance. The paramedic says, you're going to have to kneel on the floor. I don't know if you've ever been in an ambulance, but you look at those floors, it's heavily corrugated steel. And I'm thinking about my summer pants. I says to the guy, he says, not without a pillow. He says to his partner, give the pussy a pillow. I says, don't fuck with me or I'll move my fingers. We get into the ambulance. They dial into the county hospital. They're doing with their fancy telemetry, and they're getting directions from the doctor. He's trying valiantly to start an IV. This young man has lost a lot of blood. He's unconscious now, and he's trying to start an IV. And the crowd now is gathered around the ambulance, and they start pounding on the side of the ambulance. What you doing? Ain't you gonna go? Ain't you gonna help him? Go, 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 go. And they're pounding on the side of the ambulance. Little sliding door at the end, a blue and white hat appears, and he says, guys, you gotta move. They're getting restless. The paramedic mutters under his breath, shit. Jumps into the driver's seat. We drove a few blocks to the far side of the parking lot at the Chicago Stadium. He stopped there. He notified the hospital he was trying to start an IV. The IV says, negative, stat, move him now, get him here. He mutters under his breath, if I can just get this IV started. If we don't get this IV, we're going to lose him. So he worked around, and it was literally just five more seconds, and he says, I got it. Taped the IV down to the guy's arm, and off we went to county hospital. Snaked our way through the corridors, up to the second floor. There's a room up there that was simply called Ward 32. It was their trauma unit, probably the most advanced trauma unit in the history of the world. This is 1975. They describe his vital signs. The doctors look at me and he says, is that where your hand is now? And I says, yeah. He says, don't move your hand. I'm, okay. I've been told that before. I was thinking to myself, but I stood there and I watched one of the most miraculous performances, almost choreographed like a ballet. At any given moment, there were six or eight people working on this young man. They were calling out his blood pressure with a single figure, not the normal double figures we hear. It would be like 80. And then a few minutes later, 75. He had no breath sounds in his right lung. They were assuming that internal bleeding had drained down into the pleural cavity and collapsed his lung. So they put a tap into his chest. And I'm right there. I had to move so they could get this tap into his chest. An encouraging sign when they pushed this into his chest without any anesthetic was he moaned. I thought, well, he's still alive. The tube immediately filled with a gush of blood. And there was a shout, clamp it, clamp it. They couldn't afford for all this blood to escape from his cavity because he would now bleed to death internally. It was a balancing act, and this went on for quite some time. And finally, they got to the point where they came up and started paying attention to me and my hand, and they said, when we tell you, take your hand away and step straight back out of the way. So I turned, I saw I had a clear path behind me, and they started unwrapping and cutting away blood-soaked ACE bandages. And when they got to where they just my hand and his neck, they told me, now. I stepped away, never looked back. I knew from their talk that they had a vascular surgery team assembled, and he was going to be heading up to the OR for vascular surgery. I went to the back of the trauma unit, and there was a wash station back there. And they had, in those days, they had these hexachlorophene impregnated sponges. So I'm scrubbing with the hexachlorophene impregnated sponge. And suddenly, my partner shows up at my side. Where's that 4-inch compress I sent you for? He says, go fuck yourself. He says, can we go now, doctor? We laughed. The trauma unit people kind of looked at the back of the room like, what kind of macabre assholes are these? Yeah. So I says, do we have any idea who this guy is? And my partner says, I know who he is. His name is Larry Wiggins, and he lives in the Henry Horner Homes, and we're looking for Pookie. I says, well, I'm glad you did something while I was tied up. I says, let's go back to the station. I said, I want to get, it was near the end of our tour of duty. I said, I want to go home. I know I had blood on my shirt, and I was sure that there was blood on my trousers. I said, I'm going to go home and throw in a load of laundry and take a shower. And I says, I will pick up on this case tomorrow, because Larry was still alive. We came back to work the next day. Larry was in intensive care extremely critical condition. That's about the most serious condition you can get. We tried poking around to find Pookie, but one of the things we discovered, well, we knew this in advance, there was about 4 dozen Pookies in every housing project in the West Side. So we had to delineate. It was a West Side Pookie or a South Side Pookie, but we weren't getting anywhere. Second night we came back, and his condition had improved. It was now critical, not extremely critical. So Larry kind of dropped down the priority list simply because he was alive. We were homicide. We investigated murders, and Larry was improving. The third day we came back on the afternoon shift at 4:30, and our boss told us that Larry had died that morning. He had suffered a stroke, apparently from a blood clot, from the site of the original stab wound. So Larry Wiggins jumped up to the top of our priority list. He was now a homicide victim. Right after roll call, we went over to the Henry Horner homes, and this time we went right up to the apartment where Larry lived with his sisters and his mother. We knocked on the door, we were admitted. It was a quiet, somber atmosphere. And one sister, I learned later it was Larry's younger sister, leaned over to her mother, and said, Mama, this is the detective I told you about. She took about 3 steps forward and grabbed me in a bear hug. She says, sweet Jesus, you saved my baby, you saved my baby. She's got me in a bear hug, and I think, good Lord, doesn't she know? She's got to know. Her boy's been dead for about 12 hours. So I hugged her back, and I put my mouth close to her ear. I says, Mrs. Wiggins, I says, Larry died this morning. And she took a step back and looked at me and took both of my elbows in her hand. She says, Jesus put you there so we could say goodbye to him. You gave us that chance, don't you understand? You gave us a chance to tell him we loved him and say goodbye. There was a moment of embarrassed silence. I didn't know what to say. My partner, after a moment, says, we're looking for Pookie. She straightened up, strong, black matriarch that I've seen so often in the ghetto. She says, we know Pookie. We'll bring him to you. I says, Mrs. Wiggins, I says, that's our job. We don't want you to get hurt. We don't want Pookie to get hurt. And she looked at me rather indulgently, and she said, we bring him to you. She says, nothing bad gonna happen. We had no choice. We went back to our station, and sure enough, about an hour later, Mama shows up with Pookie's mama and Pookie. Pookie was a big guy, about 18, 19 years old also, but he looked kind of meek and bedraggled with his mama. They also brought 2 witnesses. So we took witnesses' statement. Pookie told us everything that happened. We called the state's attorney. We got approved for murder charges. After everything was said and done, several hours later, Mama, Pookie's mama, and the sisters walked out. I watched them from the second floor as they walked across the street to where their car was parked. I never saw 2 more resolute moms arm in arm as they marched back to their car. Strong, stalwart. In a real sense, they had both lost a son to ghetto violence. I should have felt good about it because we had a homicide investigation, we had an arrest, we had a clear up, and that was always our goal. But the victory to me was hollow because I hadn't really saved anybody. Thank you.
So we wake up in the morning, we get dressed, we put our shoes on, we head out into the world, pretty sure we're going to come back at night, get undressed, take our shoes off, go to bed, and we plan on getting up the next day and doing the same thing. And we hope, we plan, that becomes this framework, kind of a, it helps us in our life. And we make our plans based on the idea that we're going to be able to come home and continue to do what we've been doing. And John Lennon said, life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. And I woke up one morning, I wasn't wearing any of my own clothes. I had a tube up my nose going down into my stomach to drain it. I had a tube coming out of each side to drain each lung. I had a morphine drip and a catheter and a life support machine beeping next to me. At the foot of my bed was a surgeon who had worked on me all night to save my life. And next to him were two homicide detectives. Now, for the record, when your day starts out with two homicide detectives telling you what happened to you last night, it's going to be downhill from there. It turns out that there's a gang in Brooklyn that had, as part of an initiation, three guys came into the village, and to move up into the upper echelon of the gang, these guys had to kill somebody that night. So they sat waiting on Thompson Street for a guy to come around the corner. They had a lookout at either end of the block. Lookouts gave the go-ahead. It was the night before Thanksgiving, so the streets were very deserted. And this guy is walking down the block. He gets his keys out of his pocket. These three guys are coming towards him. He puts the keys into the lobby of his building, the lobby door. He goes in. The door closes behind him. He pushes the elevator button, and these guys are locked out. He gets in the elevator, goes up to his apartment, takes his clothes off, goes to bed, has no idea what just didn't hit him. I'm the next guy. So I'm walking down the block. I don't live there. And these kids jump on me, and there's three. They have their knives, they're out, they're up their arm like that. I had no, did not see it coming. There were no words exchanged. They just pounced on me and began to stab me. Took one in the neck. The other one went up my side, cut my heart. Both lungs were collapsed. Now, I grew up in Wyoming, learned how to fight. Then I went to school at Notre Dame. I was on the boxing team, which is one of the very lucky things that saved my life that night is I got one very good straight right punch and knocked the middle guy out. And then I started to scream and ran down the block. And the police caught the middle guy because everyone else ran and left him. They couldn't carry him. And then they told him that he was going to get the electric chair if he didn't give everyone up. He gave up all the names. And so these two homicide detectives had mugshots. And the surgeon had told them that I had about a 2% chance of living through the day. And they wanted me to identify these guys before I died. Now, nobody told me that I only had a 2% chance. And I didn't really understand why these guys were bugging me to identify these people. And I felt very bad. And I didn't, too queasy. And I just said, I can't really put anything together from last night, and I don't want to make a wrong identification, so, you'll have to do something else with fingerprints or something, because I don't feel good making this identification. And so I spent the next 3 or 4 days on life support, and I beat the odds. And I come off life support, and I go into the intensive care unit, and the little nurse comes in, and she's got the clipboard, and she said, I'd like to talk to you about your insurance. And I was self-employed at the time, so I like to say I was insurance free. And she was dismayed to learn that. And the next morning they came in and told me, man, you are looking really good. We think you should get better at home. And they pulled all the tubes out and they gave me a little jar of Percocet and a cane, and I ended up at home. Now, I had a few hundred stitches from surgery. I had multiple stab wounds. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't lay on my back. I couldn't lay on my side. I couldn't lay on my stomach. And every time I started to doze off, the movie would start, and I just was just engulfed in terror. So the days and the weeks went by without, you know, my stitches came out, but I just was not getting very much better. And, you know, in New York, if you can't go to your job and pay your rent, you don't get to stay in your apartment. So I was getting calls from the district attorney's office to help him with this case. I have now five guys to go to jail for attempted murder. And I would go down to visit him, and it would be a very emotional time for me because I didn't like to walk outside. And yet, then there were moments like I'd be walking past the deli and I would see all the flowers in the buckets, and it would be like out of a Disney movie where all the flowers would start to sing, and I was so happy to be alive. And I was just like, I would feel things and hear sounds and watch just details, everything. I was just picking it all up like I'd just gotten a fresh start at everything. And yet the rest of my life was just shit. And I would just alternate between this, like, these intense moments where, like, the essence of existence was just erupting around me. And then I would just be crying because I would see two Puerto Rican kids and any kid that looked like he had a hint of menace, which they all do. Every kid, every teenager is like projecting menace. And I would lose it. And the feeling was like, you know, if you're driving late at night on a road and it's snowing and the road's icy and it's late, you're going a little fast, you're coming into a turn, and you feel all the wheels start to slip. And you look, you see the guardrail, and you're like, there's nothing I can do. Brake, steering, I'm going to hit. And then you hit the dry pavement, and the car shudders, and you have control again, and you keep going. And then you feel it, the taste in your mouth and behind your knees. I would get that feeling 8 and 10 times a day when I left my apartment, and I was just unraveling, coming apart. And I end up getting evicted. I come home, and the marshals have put all of my possessions on the sidewalk, and the homeless guys are picking through, and I got nothing. I have nowhere to go. And I have an appointment with the district attorney. So I go to him, and I just break down. I start to cry, and I'm like, you know, I'm not going to have any phone anymore. And he says, well, let me give you the number for victims assistance. A little late, I thought. And so I take the number and I go to the victims assistance office, just walked there, and there I'm waiting. I don't have an appointment or anything. I just figure I'll wait till somebody talks to me. And this very nice young girl comes out. Like, she looked just like Reese Witherspoon in Legally Blonde. She's got the ponytail and the black turtleneck and the clipboard, and I'm in a very dark place, and I see her and I feel like we're not going to connect. And she takes me back to her cubicle, and then I know we're not going to connect, because on the wall next to her monitor is the poster, I know you know it, of the kitten and the branch. It says, hang in there, baby. And so I just sit there kind of looking at her, and she gives me a list of places that I can go for free group counseling in the Bronx, and she puts me on a list for subsidized housing, which will possibly in 18 months, you know, give me something. And then I can fill out Medicaid, and she gives me this mental envelope full of all these forms, and I feel like I'm a drowning man who has just been thrown a kit to build a boat. And I walk out of there with all this paperwork, and I go to see this bartender that I knew, this very cute Lebanese-Canadian poet bartender. She's rocking this Simone de Beauvoir look, and she's just super smart and funny, and she listens. And I just say I'm homeless, you know, and so she lets me stay on her couch. And the thing about her that was just incredible was that she listened. And I found that when I tried to talk to people about this turmoil in my head and how my life was just unraveling, people generally had one of three responses. The first response was, everything happens for a reason. And that made me want to stab them 6 times and see if they knew what the reason for that was. And the next thing that people said was, you've just got to pull yourself together and put that behind you. You're fine now. Just move on. Like, you can't dwell on the past.
And I just wanted to punch him in the face and just keep punching him and just say, so are you able to just, you know, move on? Like, I really could use some advice from somebody who knows what they're talking about, not somebody just dishing out these platitudes. And then the next thing that people said, and again, everyone, they meant well. They just had no fucking idea what to say. And instead of saying nothing and listening, they said, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And the problem with that for me was that I actually did not believe that. I mean, I went to college, you know, I sat up all night in the student union drinking coffee. I read Nietzsche. I just had this feeling that things could happen in your life that would break you, that you would not recover from, that not only would you not be stronger, that I was never going to have what I had. My health was shot, my business was gone, my apartment, like I had nothing, and not only would I never even be stronger, I just wouldn't even have ever again what I had. And so I'm, you know, this is making me sad and then kind of mad because it just seems like nothing is working out. And I would take my little bag of tools that I had. Before I got hurt, I had this small furniture shop in Dumbo. I had built custom furniture. So I still had a bag of chisels. And I would go up to the Upper East Side with my screw gun and my chisels. And, you know, if you're you have your own tools and English is your first language and you knock on the door of a construction site, pretty much you can have a job for the day. And I knew what I was doing. And so pretty soon they'd say, like, you know, put him down in the basement on the baseboard and see how he's going. And then, you know, I'm working on some millionaire's townhouse, you know, with just incredible stuff going on, marble and rosewood everywhere. And I'm in this library and I'm, you know, mortising an offset pivot hinge into this inlaid door. And the thought of like this beauty and this like craftsmanship and what these people are going to be able to live in, and like the just the beauty of what we were creating in on the job site contrasted with my life, and then like the evil that had happened to me, and I just started to cry. So there I'm on my hands and knees crying, and you know, one of the Mexican laborers is like goes to the foreman, he's like, that dude you hired, man, he's crying in the basement. So the, you know, the foreman's this Irish guy, and he comes down and he's like, you know, Eddie, here, you can't use you anymore today. Here's, go have a drink, man. And, you know, paid me through the day. And I just go and I'm sitting on a bench at, near Central Park. And I'm just feeling like, you know, my girlfriend's worried about me because I've gone from being the sad guy to being the mad guy. And I'm like verging on being this bad guy because I just am so dark all the time. And I see this dude go walking by with his shiny briefcase and his shiny shoes and his perfect suit and his silk tie knotted and his hair's all shined and combed and perfect. And I just think, I'm going to tackle that fucker and kneel on his chest and just punch him in the face and make him hurt and just say to him, you think that you're where you are because you're good, but you're not. You're where you are because you're lucky, man. A car could jump the curb. Some fuckers could stab you at night. Like, you are lucky. You're not good. You didn't get where you are because you're so fucking smart or talented. Just, you didn't get hit. That's why you're here. And I want you to remember that. And I just wanted to hit this guy so bad. And I'm thinking, better not do that. And I let him keep walking. And then what hits me is, I just wanted to hurt a perfect stranger to make a point about what's wrong with my life. And in that moment, I realized I have just become closer to the guys who stabbed me than I am to who I was before I was hurt. And I see there's this path for me where I'll join those guys on the road to fucking hell. I'll be alone. I'll be in prison. I'll do whatever I want to do, and I'll end up like them. And I don't want to do that. I have enough wherewithal to not want to do that. And the next thing that occurs to me is that I can't ever have what I had before. It's gone. That guy, I can't get back to that. I'm different. I'm fundamentally and totally changed. And I need to do something that I've never done before. And then I think, I've got this girl, and she's like, I'll just go tell her, like, I'm going to be different now. I put all this other crap aside. I'm going to start again. I'm going to have this, like, energy, and I'm totally psyched, and I go running home to her, and I'm like, I'm going to be different. Things are going to be great. Will you marry me? And she's like, no. And so but she's enthused by my enthusiasm, and she gives me, you know, she waits, and so we try and work it out. And a couple years goes by, and she knows I'm never going to ask her again, so she asks me, and I agree. And then a little more time goes by, and we kind of get a routine back, and I get a better job and start doing things again, and kind of put the world back into some kind of perspective where I don't really trust the world again, but at least I have it at arm's length. And we decide we can have a kid. So I have a 4-year-old daughter now. So I put her shoes on in the morning and I head out to work.
Well, that is all for this, the Best of Risk True Crime Stories. Number one, we just heard from Ed Gavigan. And before Ed, we heard from the late Jim Paydar. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.